Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The Long View with Kevin Thompson, Indigenous Life for the Future, taking the long view of our time here on Earth, and in space, possibly, too. Well, here it is. It's my third episode. It is August 15th, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time in the year 2015, 8-15-15. And here I am with another life of life indigenous, another week of the life indigenous having just passed, and here we start another one. What is there to talk about? Interesting stuff on YouTube, seeing the Earth and the Moon in their actual proportions and their distance, and a photograph taken by one of the space probes leaving the Earth-Moon system, traveling farther out, and you see the Earth and the Moon, and they seem like they're so far apart. They don't look, you know, you think it's just a little bit of ways away. It's a distance which is equal to several of the Earth's diameters. That's how far away the Moon is. And they're talking about mining the Moon. I saw this on TV. They say they're going to start, there are rare minerals. I can't call them rare Earth minerals, but they're rare minerals on the Moon. So companies are thinking of ways to mine that. Now, I'm wondering if that's wise, because the Moon keeps the Earth's orbit and rotation in balance so that our seasons are not as wacky as some of them on the other planets. So if you take minerals off the Moon, you change the weight of the Moon, or you change, more properly, the mass of the Moon. And that could upset the balance. They could upset the balance if the Moon affects the Earth. Well, the Earth, what's unique about the Earth and the Moon inside this solar system is that the Moon is fairly massive in relation to the mass of the Earth. It's one of the biggest satellite bodies in relative to the planet in orbit. So if you affect it, if you take part of the mass away, what happens to that balance between those two? It has to be significant. Well, just a thought. As for being here on Earth, and as for being an indigenous person on Earth, what it might mean to be indigenous, and the thing about space, and I have reasons why I've always been interested in the space program and what space has to tell us about life on Earth, is that though it seems to be an entire rejection of what it is to be indigenous, I mean, we say we're children of the Earth. The Earth is our mother, right? So we're not going to leave our mother. We're part of it, right? Yet, as the space program talks about leaving the Earth, you're stuck with this realization that these people who are traveling, living in close quarters in these spaceships, colonies, they're going to have to be really tight with each other. They're going to have to know how to work together. It's going to be basically a communal tribal existence. So as they leave Mother Earth, which the tribal people of the world, for lack of a better term, have always called home, as they leave Mother Earth, they have to become more tribal to survive. Certain type of person or people could become these space travelers, and some just cannot be. Yeah, we see in the movies that there are these wild cowboy types, you know. But, I mean, if you wouldn't got drunk and fired off a pistol inside a spaceship, you function the thing and you kill everybody. You just can't be that kind of reckless wacko that we see in Hollywood of what space astronauts would be like. They pick scientists. They pick scientists and military people who are disciplined and know how to work in a team. It's a communal existence. I mean, let's say you're on a Mars colony. I mean, you have a little bedroom or living quarters, and that's it. I mean, but you're going to build yourself a mansion. You're not building a mansion up there. I mean, that could be the expression of your ego here on Earth, but it just won't work up there. It's going to be communal. there won't be a lot of extra material goods to acquire. Things will be geared, activities will be geared to the survival of the group, the tribal existence, the hunter-gatherer existence. It's not about acquiring a lot of stuff. What are you going to acquire? Where are you going to put it? So oddly enough, as mankind, humankind, leaves Earth, we have to relearn some of the old lessons our indigenous ancestors learned millennia ago. That just seems to be the case. And if they talk about terraforming Mars and creating an ecosystem on Mars that can sustain life and can sustain human life, if that becomes feasible, they'll have to become extremely good caretakers of those worlds, those eco-worlds or giant space terrariums or habitats they create. They'll have to be micromanagers, if need be, of this ecosystem. They'll have to be the true caretakers of the Earth. So it may be that Western civilization relearns the lesson of Mother Earth by leaving Mother Earth, and will realize how much more they need to pay attention to it. So here we are, the indigenous people, the caretakers of the Earth. And most of us are happy to be that. And please, I want people to call in. So here we go. To call in, to be a guest on the show, you call in this number. Area code 929-47705. That's for guests to call in and speak to me. Area code 929-477-1305. And that number will reach me as we broadcast today, August 15th at 11 p.m. We're on from 11 p.m. for a couple of hours here. And this is 2015 if you're listening live. So feel free to call in to 929-477-1305. 929-477-1305. This is Kevin Thompson with The Longview Indigenous Life for the Future. But what does it mean to be indigenous? What are the ways it means? Ways and means it is to be an indigenous person. I encounter, as part of my job, people from Mexico and from Ecuador and Peru. And they are indigenous. I'm at the street vendor. I say, ¿Estás indígena? ¿Estás indígena? You may know the indígena. And he says, yeah, it's me. Soy también. And es for indígena. Mi tribu es Mexcogo. And then we talk. And he said, hermanos, brothers, you know, you rap with the people and the tribal people. And they live together. And they live in many ways communally. And that's how these chains of people can migrate into the state. And there's always a place for them to live, and they work, and they work a lot. And there's child care for them, and a lot of the resources are combined. And they're living in tenement buildings, okay, tenement buildings in New York City. But I see that as in some ways, the true tribal life. And here in the United States, the emphasis on what makes a tribe is what exists in a government roll number somewhere. And there's these recognized tribal governments, and I'm glad they exist, don't get me wrong. But the emphasis for these individuals that I meet from Latin America, who often still speak their indigenous language, who know their indigenous customs, and still work together like a giant family to take care of themselves and advance. I think they have a real key on what indigenous or what tribes meant. They were survival mechanisms. They were survival mechanisms which carried people through time and space. And they never forgot that. And in many cases, what is on paper here in the United States or here on some government agency file in Ecuador or Mexico or Peru, their feeling and connection to each other is what makes them a people. That's what makes them indigenous, Indian. That's what it is. And I'm afraid that we lose sight of that here in the United States, where there is so much emphasis, enrollment. Speaking of which, one of the most sinister things going on in the whole enrollment is the dis-enrollment. Several tribes have tried successfully so far disenrolled whole families from their tribes. And they just basically go back and say that some particular ancestor, they go back 70, 80 years and say this person wasn't really a tribal member, they weren't full-blooded or blah, blah, blah. And this person loses their membership retroactively. This person is deceased. You're basically like taking the dead person off the rolls, and therefore all their descendants are taken off the rolls too. And this means that many of these families who've lived in this community for generations all of a sudden lose their status. They lose their tribal citizenship, their tribal membership, the right to get their health care taken care of. They lose the right for education, the right to play on the playground. Some of them are allowed to stay there physically because there are often non-tribal members living on the res. If it's a big one, there's going to be like some employees and others there. They get to stay, possibly. And this is this total removal of people, which tends to happen in tribes that have a casino and have some sort of cash payout. It will reduce the number of getting the cash payout. And so they say in the name of tribal sovereignty, our sacred sovereignty, we get the right to kick out and do whatever we feel like, basically, and the government has nothing to say about it. So that's the way it is. That's the level of the lowest level of which quote-unquote Native American life has sunk. It's nothing to be proud of. I can't imagine the tribes in the past, and before they were on the reservation, they'd just kick people out. But we don't like you because you're not. We decide based on sovereignty given to us by the U.S. government. You're not Indian enough to be in our family anymore, so you're out. What happened to the responsibility to take care of people, of your own people? No, I just don't get that. It's mind-boggling how these decisions get made. The level of greed and selfishness that allows the disenrollment to happen. I wonder if the United States government, what does it say about the membership status of the disenrolled? If one is an Indian, then one is a member of a tribe. Does one cease to be Indian when one is no longer a member of a tribe? Does that mean that if to be an Indian means to be a member of a recognized tribe, does that mean that the status disappears once the tribe is no longer recognized by the government, or the tribe itself chooses to no longer recognize an individual? If that's all Indianness means, if that's all it is, that it's just category on paper, then what does it really mean? Well, that's partly why I have this show. I want to explore what it can mean beyond that, beyond the paper. What does it mean to be indigenous? As for me, my indigenous background is from the southeastern United States, Creek, Apalachee, the people who occupied a wide area from the South Carolina coast westward, almost into Mississippi, where their linguistic relatives, the Choctaw, took over from that point. They're often called Muscogee and Creek. There are different ethnicities within that, including the Uchi and the Shawnee, and several related Muscogean and Choctaw dialects, and idioms and languages were spoken. For shorthand, I'm Creek. That's what we always told in our family. We were Creek. Muskogee is a language which I have and which I teach online as on YouTube as Mega Kevin 49. Muskogee is a language we speak in our home even today. And so I live in the Appalachian Mountain, so at the northern end of the Appalachian Mountain. And the Appalachian Mountains were named after the Appalachian people who lived in what is now Georgia. So I live in a mountain chain which is named after my ancestors. I guess I could be considered an Appalachian of sorts. And where I grew up was also in the northern Appalachians and is actually covered by the Appalachian Regional Commission, the ARC, which is a governmental body which includes counties of many states which lie within the Appalachian region. And it goes, it's a huge area. It would be a decent-sized state itself. So that's where I'm coming from spatially. I'm not so much, I'm a displaced indigenous person, but not so much spatially because I'm still in an area that my ancestors occupied or lived in. So where does that leave the rest of me and the rest of us? I always say here, you know, if you are displaced spiritually from your tradition, learn them, learn that history. There's plenty of resources now to learn it, attend the event. It's not an easy journey sometimes, but it is rewarding. It is rewarding. There's a lot of things that go on in indigenous, in Indian country. I encourage people who don't know a lot, you know, don't read books about Indians. Read books by Indians. Read books by Indians or Native people. Talk about their own selves, their own philosophies, their own life history, their own family, their own culture. Read that. For one thing, people write about their history, usually write about themselves as if they're alive, right? And their family is alive. It's a living experience for them. And the non-Indian scholarship is focused on what was lost, what tribe used to be, what tribes are extinct, what artifacts they found. But not about living people. How are they living? What are Native people doing now? What do they think now? What do they think about the current election? Of course Native people have opinions about that stuff. Of course we do. Anyway. So in any case, there are a lot of movements in Indian country and in the fringes of Indian country. Some of them, I think I don't want to go in here to bash other people's philosophies, and I'm certainly not trying to draw hate mail. But here's the thing. There are a lot of people in Native America who have been here a very long time, and some of them have absorbed ancestry from other races, the white and the black, forces that are trying to discredit the Indian status of full populations who they decide are not the real Indian people. I can't get with that. Indigenous people of the Americas come in all colors, all hair textures. I draw inspiration from the government of Bolivia under the current president, Evo Morales. And everybody, including the Afro-Bolivians and the Euro-Bolivians, and along with the indigenous Bolivians who are the numerical majority, the official government philosophy is that they're all children of Mother Earth, Pachamama, I believe it, if I may take it wrong. They're all children of Mother Earth. And they're not trying to differentiate them and say who isn't really and who isn't. And there's an interesting thing. You should really check out what's going on in Bolivia. In most of Latin America, the public face is a very, very European face. The newscasters, the fashion models, the actresses, the talk show hosts are the most European looking of people, Northern European. They barely look Mediterranean even, like which you might expect being the Spanish legacy of Latin America. They look more Northern European. And of course, there were German immigrants into Spain and into Latin America, into those countries. So, of course, you know, there are people who do look German who are ethnically German, and that's fine, but not the entire population. And so in Bolivia, that's changed. So you look at the newscasters and the women doing the newscast look indigenous. And they're wearing the bowler hat that the indigenous Andean people wear. Sometimes they're wearing the shawl. And they're there delivering the news. Okay? They're not taking the fashion sense that what it's supposed to look like is a newscast out of Sweden. It's supposed to look like a newscast out of Bolivia, out of the Andes. Bolivia has done a lot of wonderful things. Like there's this clock at the clock tower in one of the cities. It's an old clock tower, and they reversed the numbers on it. Because if you look at the numbers of the conventional European clock, the 1 through 12, that's a digital type, the type of the hands around it. And you see the hands go a certain direction, you don't think anything of it. Well, that's based on the direction of the sun if you're in the northern hemisphere and you're facing south, okay? And the direction of the sun, if you imagine a clock, as you're staying up, you get up in the morning, sun rises to your east, and it's at your left hand. You're facing due south, your left hand is going to be in the east, the rising sun. If you imagine stretching your arm out and bringing it north across your face, imagine at the hand of the clock as it moves up from the last two numbers, from the 9, 10, 11, and 12, on the clock face, right? That's because it's the clock that the Western European clock that we use is based on the Northern Hemisphere. That's what it looks like in the Northern Hemisphere, because that's the way it looks to the sun. But if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the opposite. The sun is the other direction, and the clock for the sun appears to move the other way. So in Bolivia, they have this change of clock face the other way, so it looks quote-unquote backward. But it's not really backward. It's just it's seen from a different perspective. The Northern Hemisphere perspective is not the only perspective. Bolivia also has taken on architecture. We get architecture that doesn't look like an imitation of the Spanish. And they're trying to design it with their own indigenous cultural sensibility, taste. A little more colorful. It's got some different motifs in there. It's interesting stuff. And it looks kind of like if the country had been conquered, but it hadn't had its culture eradicated at the same time. So it absorbs, like India, still there's things in India, you still buildings, the temples, they're still there. You can still tell it's India. Even if people are driving cars and a lot of people are speaking English, you can still tell it's India, that it's not England, okay? But a lot of Latin America, it looks like it's still an outgrowth of Spain. But Bolivia is starting to redo its architecture so it looks like it was always had its own culture intact. And that's what they're doing now. They also did some other great things. There's they took some money in from the government treasury, and they built a cable car system. This cable car system is massive, and it's for commuters. It connects the city of La Paz with this suburb, which is like up on another mountain. And supposedly, this cable car system, you can look it up on YouTube, can carry 20,000 people at a time at any given time. So thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are in these cable cars riding to work every day. And they aren't gigantic cable cars. Each one holds about 4 or 5 people. And it's just this massive system. And it's fabulous. You can look at it. That's just some interesting stuff. But it's interesting that the government decided they wanted to do something for the people. And the traffic jams in the city were unbelievable. Too much pollution. It was slow. And they said, let's do it for the people. And so they made it's a major, unique infrastructure project. I say, check it out on YouTube. Take a look at it on YouTube. So And you can tell I'm in a good mood. I'm in a good mood today. Yeah, I have no reason to be in a bad mood as far as what is going on in my personal life. Not at all. Not bad at all. So, last week, I spoke a lot about Jimi Hendrix and how I thought his indigenous background was underplayed in the most of the official biographies and documentaries about him. Spoke about the another Netflix movie documentary. This may be the last time, which is about Seminole and Creek Nations in Oklahoma. And speaking of the Seminole and Creek Nations, who are closely related people, and I'm thinking back to Craig Womack, Creek author and professor. I believe he's at Emory University in Atlanta right now. And he said that he quoted someone else talking about the multifacets of the Muscogee Creek Nation and how it came to be. And someone said, if someone explains the history of the Creek Nation to you and you understand it, they ain't told it right. That's a paraphrase. But if you understand it, they have not told it to you correctly, because it's really complicated, and any simple explanation is not doing it justice. It's that complicated. Any simple explanation is not doing it justice. But I wanted to take it back a little deeper into this and about the tradition of indigenous people towards stories and toward lessons. And I take to something called the trickster tale. I found a book of one once in an army library about African trickster tales. And they were from various parts of West and Central Africa. And there were these different stories about how, you know, one thief claimed to be the better thief before the king. And the first thief stole something, which was pretty impressive. And the second thief even did better. He stole the loincloth off the other thief's waist without him even realizing it. And it ends with a question, which you think is the better thief? And that's how it ends. In fact, most of those these African trickster tales, ended with a question. So you're trying to imagine when these stories are being told to people over the years, what's the point? And the point was to make you think. That's why it ends with a question and not an answer. A question and not a moral. The moral of the story is you should never do that. You know, that's not how it ends. So jumping back onto to this side of the ocean, and there was, I think it was Claudio Sant cited a Creek storyteller or something, and he said the effect that if I tell you a story, this is in the Creek context, Muscogee Creek context, if I tell you a story and you understand it right then, I have not told it right. I want to repeat that. If I tell you a story and you understand it right away, I have not told it right. And that says, how could that be? It doesn't seem to make sense to a certain mindset. And what I think it means is that the purpose of the stories, and I've read a lot of the Creek stories. They're in a collection by Ernest Gouge called Totka Muchosi, which means new fire. I've even taught from it on my YouTube channel. And it's for linguistic purposes. And the stories don't seem to have an obvious point a lot of the time. But the purpose of the stories was to make you think, to train young minds to think, not to give them the answers, but to think. Listen, hear, think about what it is. And I'm not going to tell you what the answer is. And the fact that you see this so common on two sides of the world, for me, that says something about what I would call the first civilization's way of operating. Because I believe it, and the evidence is showing this, that we have not touched, scratched the surface on a civilization that spanned the globe. It was the civilization of the tribal peoples, and it lasted for thousands of years. And the civilization which we live in now, most for the most part, has been formed by the rise of very large world religious systems. Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam are some of the biggest. And then also the ones out of China, Confucianism and such too. And these civilizations, which had a lot of centralization politically and economically, also had these theocratic systems and these philosophical systems, which were centralized also. So there was a kind of a top-down philosophy in how life went. And we kind of, in fact, believe that that is what makes, quote-unquote, civilization. Even though many of the people in the world, even up until the last few, even up to the last 100 years, lived outside of these systems, or at least outside of their educational portion, so they weren't being indoctrinated by it. They were in the hinterland. There were still the primitive people in the forest, quote-unquote. So they weren't being indoctrinated in the system of the people. And that's where most of the world used to be. And here's a thought. And the propaganda from Western civilization, it has reached the highest levels of personal thought. I'll grant that it's had the highest levels of technological thought. Technology is pretty impressive. So it brought it to the brink of destruction. But if you take that part out of it, it's pretty impressive. But in any case, if you think about whether we are developed mentally as well as we were 10,000 years ago, individually how we were developed mentally and spiritually, we might fall short compared to our ancestors back then. I think that to some extent, the degree to which we have relied on these centralized systems, the monotheistic religions and the other theocratic state religions, that we have lost some of our capacity to think, the capacity which what the trickster story tried to encourage, but was considered necessary for survival. Isn't it Albert Murray, who's a Black American author, who said something interesting about the slave trade from West Africa? And he took the notion that a lot of the people who were brought to the Americas from West Africa had come from the smaller societies, the weaker ones. The big states which made their money off the slave trade conquered the smaller tribes, the smaller communities, the villages that were more or less autonomous. They were not under the thumb or not under the theocratic thumb of the centralized state. And so these people were the ones who were mostly getting shipped over here as slaves. And Albert Murray said something. He said it was worth noting that there are all these survivals of African religions throughout the Americas, but Islam doesn't seem to have done so well. And it seemed that up to 1 in 5 of the Africans brought to the United States were Muslim. Why is the Muslim religion why did it not survive? It came back, it was revived. And now many African Americans practice it, but why didn't it survive? And it seems to me, and this is what Albert Murray was suggesting, was that the peoples from the smaller communities, who are not from the monotheistic communities, had more flexibility of mind because they had a more flexibility of mind, and when they came over here and they're under this oppressive system, they have more options. Okay, they don't have as many taboos against what they're eating that they're pork. If pork is the only thing you're offered to eat and you're a Muslim, what do? You just starve to death or you just eat it anyway. I mean, that's a choice the Muslim slaves must have had here in the United States. So what do they do? But if you don't have, if you're not Islamic, if you're not Christian, if you don't have, if you're not Jewish, if you don't have these restrictions on you, then you can adapt. You can adapt. You can adapt when you don't have your holy books, when you don't have your copy of the Bible, when you don't have your Quran. You have to find some other way to put together a worldview that works for you. And I think that was the survivability of what I would call the pre-centralized kind of sensibility. And the trickster tales, the tribal tales, reflect that. They reflect that earlier way of operating psychologically and spiritually in the world. And I don't think that we have really cut the Western, I'll say we, but you know, the Western establishment has not come to appreciate all that might be. And that in some ways it may have been superior to what we accept now as what makes up a sound and sane mind. What did it really teach? How did still brain sizes have actually been declining? 10,000 years ago, our ancestors had bigger brains than we do now. Well, they used their brains for more stuff. I mean, I turn on the light, I flip on a switch. Okay? And imagine if I had to start the fire from scratch. There are people in the world who do know how to do that. But what about when everyone in the world knew how to do that? Everyone in the world knew how everyone, if you at least divided between the two sexes, male and female, knew how to build a house, how to fish, hunt, and cook and kill food for themselves, how to process all types of plants and animals and stuff that came through, how to sew and make your own clothes, because you had to do everything. There wasn't a lot of specialization. And so most people had to do most of the things that society required. So the brains had to be flexible enough to do it. Now we're so specialized, we don't have to think about a lot of the things we do. So what have we lost? What are we giving up? Are we becoming victims of our own success? Will the machine eventually do all our work for us? Because we aren't physically strong enough to do them, or in fact, even eventually, not even smart enough to do these things for ourselves. Well, I hope it's not that late in human history, but it's something to think about. Like a lot of the schools no longer teach cursive writing. How necessary is it? I don't know. You can type everything on the computer. You can still find the workbooks that teach cursive. And if you have someone you want to teach cursive to, I get those books. If you can't read cursive, you can't read the written documents. Yes, go to Ancestry.com. You look at the census records. Those had to be digitized. Someone had to read the handwriting because they were handwritten records written by the census takers. They had to go figure out what those words were for the handwriting and type them in. And then they became digitized. When I first started doing genealogical research, I went to a Mormon stake genealogy library that was open to the public within certain hours and by appointment. And I looked on these microfiche and microfilms of census records. I had to crank through this microfilm viewer. And there were these census records. The film was, in fact, a photograph of these notebooks just full of lists and lists and lists of names. So handwriting, and this is one of the beauties of the written word, is that if you write on paper or on something that can be preserved, that as long as someone else can read it, available. Now, think of the forms of communication we don't have, like cassette tapes. I still have cassette players around, okay? If those cassette players break, I won't be able to play my cassette tapes, which are magnetic cassette tapes, because We've moved to digital, DVD. And now I'm hearing the computers no longer have built-in DVD players, so they're not going to be using it. We're dropping two levels of communication already. But I still have notebooks of things that I wrote 30 years ago, and I have physical books, hard copies, from longer ago than that. And I can still read those directly, while there's stuff 10 years ago that I can't access anymore or won't be able to access pretty soon. So the skill of writing is valuable. It is valuable. And we should not forget those skills. To use those skills, and they develop our minds. Yes, it takes longer to do it, and that's precisely the point. It does take longer to learn to read and write with cursive. But it develops a piece of the brain, a tool of the brain, and keeps it functioning. Just like playing a musical instrument does, I learned to speak another language. It's programming your own self to do these things. Well, now we have the computers programmed to do them for us. But all those other methods of training are forms of programming our brain, for lack of a better term. So here we are. The Long View with Kevin Thompson. If you want to call in, my number is 929-477-1305. 929-477-1305. And here we are, back. Here I am, and you have a garden out there, and I planted it too late. And the corn is tasseling. The corn is tasseling already. Of course, if you look around other people's gardens and fields, their corn is tasseling too. But their corn stalks are like three times as high as mine, because they planted them earlier. But that's interesting, because the corn does not do well in the frost. I recall seeing a cornfield of brown corn that was killed by an early August frost in upstate New York back in the 1970s. I saw that with my own eyes. So I remember that corn does not do well in frost. So the corn is tasseling. And this tells me something about the corn, the maize plant. It knows what time of year it is. Because I was always under the impression, and this is something I'm learning. I'm learning this week, that the plant knows when it's time to tassel and get ready to start flowering and producing its corn cob and everything. That it was based on some timetable of the plant's age. So at 3 months, it would start doing this, or 3 or 4 months, whatever. And that seemed to make sense. So you plant it in let's say early late April, and in a few months it's nice and tall and it tassels in July because it's like a 3 month period. That's when it does it. But no, that's not what happened. It tassels because of the time of year it is. Because why is my corn, which was planted too late, why is it tasseling now? Because it knows that the frost is coming. Not because of its age; it's younger. It's been planted later than the other corn I see, but it knows the time. How does the corn know that the frost is coming? The winter is coming. How does it know that? So the timetable of the corn is not entirely internal. It reaches a certain size and somehow it tassels. It's tasseling because of the time of year it is. So the corn knows what time of year it is. And that's just fascinating to me. The things you learn from plants. I used to wonder why the leaves had to lose, the tree had to lose their leaves for the snow. The pines don't, the evergreen, the conifers, they keep this. Until a snowstorm, I think on October 30th or 31st, the Halloween blizzard, all this snow fell quickly. And it just wreaked havoc. And tree limbs were just coming down all over the place, and they would knock out power lines as they went down. And then I realized something. The leaves leave the tree in part because of the smell. Those leaves, which were still on the tree that hadn't even yet turned their autumn colors, caught all that snow, which they were never supposed to catch, and it has brought down tree branches all over the place. So that's why it happened. And I never really thought about that until that experience. The things you learn just by observing and seeing when things are just off just a little bit, it is important to learn from the plants. The plants are, they give us our oxygen, they give us our food directly or indirectly. And corn maize is a domestication of a grass that lives in Mesoamerica. It's an invention of human beings who domesticated it. Mankind. That's it. Well, probably more likely it was actually womankind, because in Mesoamerican societies, that's Mexico, Central America, the women are in charge of the agriculture, the farming, the gardening, the domestication of crops. So I suspect that women had a big part to do, womankind, had a big part to do with the domestication of maize and corn. It's now one of the most important foodstuffs on the planet, in that it feeds not only us, it feeds human livestock and its products. All these byproducts are used in hundreds of industrial products. Invented, coaxed into existence by people in Central America, women most likely. Something to think about. Something to think about for the future. I heard someone say recently on the radio, NPR, I think, and he was saying, because humankind, even Western civilization, is behind what it should be. It's worked so hard to uneducate and not educate so many of the people in it, both in the developing world and certain ethnic groups inside Western civilization, that probably, almost certainly, a lot of geniuses never got to express their intelligence, never got to get into college, never got into engineering, into research. They were so struck trying to survive, trying to keep themselves out of prison, trying to avoid out-and-out violence against themselves and their families. They never got the opportunities, the luxuries of education and business and creativity. And as humankind as a whole, we are behind what we should be. And I've always thought that about this on a slightly different deal. Like right now, they're trying to push solar. Well, I was around in the 70s, the 1970s, and there was this oil embargo imposed from OPEC, Middle East, based on the U.S.'s involvement with Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And there was massive gas shortages, and people ran wine down for miles to get gas, and it was just a mess. There was all this talk about conserving energy. The prices got high. This included heating oil. So we had to talk about how to insulate houses. So there's a lot of the talk about how to insulate windows and insulate houses to protect them so that the heat doesn't leak out, came out of that period. But they never pushed the solar because the oil prices came back down, and now all of a sudden we're back to fossil fuels, burning fossil fuels. We got plenty of it. There's no reason to stop. Now, if you tell me that if the technological effort had been spent onto creating the alternative sources of wind and solar and even tidal power, if that had been pushed back in 1975, don't you think we'd been farther along with it by now? Don't you think that if every structure had solar panels on them since like 1980, which is over 30 years now, don't you think that that a lot of these things wouldn't be happening. We probably wouldn't be building these nuclear power plants. We wouldn't even have any reason. We'd have no reason to consider them. If we were using less of the fossil fuel, we might not have had a few of our last few wars in the Middle East, because we would have had no reason to fight them. We might be ahead, farther ahead in space travel, farther ahead in the quality of life for most people, especially the people who were in the war zones that have, where these wars have been fought over fossil fuels. They wouldn't have to be suffering. They would be prosperous parts of the world where new ideas and business and medicine and art would be coming out of. And now, of course, these people on those places aren't doing that at all. They're fleeing. The cities are abandoned. The towns are abandoned. And the growth and brain power is stunted by poor nutrition. All of these things are happening there now instead of what's happening. If they'd been fighting a war in Silicon Valley 20 years ago and it was wrecked, there wouldn't be any geniuses coming out of it. Anyone still there would be surviving. It'd be like Beirut. It'd be like Baghdad. That's what Silicon Valley would be if it had been wrecked by civil wars for the last 30 years. Anyone with the luxury to invent and be creative wouldn't be going there. They'd be someplace else. Anyone stuck there would be trying to get out, to get a place where they could survive at least. So humankind may very well be holding itself back. And perhaps that this is only a foretaste of what the technological marvels could have done for all of humanity, and which are now only affecting a small portion, only benefiting a small portion. And it makes you sad when you think of that. It makes me sad. We could be better off than this. There's so many people dying and suffering from things that probably could have been cured and taken care of if the global society had spent its energy and time solving those problems instead of the problems we've mostly been dealing with in nationalist-driven capitalism. I mean, that seems to be the best term to describe it. A kind of nationalist-driven capitalism that is a dominant theme in most of the world, you know, in most of the news which you see. So what can we do differently? What can we do differently? And what do we as indigenous people have to offer that's different? Well, if it collapses around us and we know how to survive on the land, we'll be at an advantage. But if it does not collapse, what do we have to offer? I already said that if there's any real serious space colonization, that it will be successful. That space colonization will essentially result will come from a more communal, cooperative, tribal kind of outlook and social model. And not this fiercely capitalistic one, individualistic capitalistic one, which governs life in the world now. That won't work. Based. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors have a model of social cooperation which will be more effective. But of course, I don't really think all of humanity, or even any significant portion, is going to be leaving Earth anytime soon. So what about the problems here now? For those of us who will be staying, well, as caretakers of the Earth, I think the indigenous perspective is right on target. When Bolivia sued and I think they passed the law and the Constitution protecting the rights of Mother Earth, you can, in Bolivia, you can actually sue on behalf of Mother Earth that some human activity is harmful to Mother Earth. This is harmful to Mother Earth. You can't do this. Let's go to court and bring an injunction to stop it because it harms Mother Earth. That law comes from a country which is embracing its indigenous presence. To sue on behalf of Mother Earth. Well, that's a good start. And there are other ideas, too. There are other ideas. What do we as indigenous people have to offer? It's our responsibility. Think of something. Think of something, criticize the dominant society for what it does wrong. That's easy to do. What will we do differently as indigenous people? That's the question. It's a question we should ask ourselves, not in an accusatory way or self-flagellating way. It's a question we should ask ourselves, come up with an answer. Come with more than one answer. That's why I take it. That's how I take it. And I like to take the lessons from the other indigenous peoples of the world, the other traditions. And when I find out about them, I take a look, a read, take a listen. We need to do that. We need to do that. And don't be quick to jump and just say, well, this is exactly what it is. Okay, then it has to be, we have to go back to matriarchy because that has all the answers. Well, matriarchy might have some of the answers. Matriarchies by themselves are not necessarily benevolent. Some conquering nations conquered others were matriarchies. Their ruling class power was handed down through the maternal line, through the mother. And they were just as brutal on the battlefield as any patriarchy. I'm sure a lot of the women who were hauling into slavery of their conquered people, I'm sure they didn't think the matriarchy was doing them much good. The matriarchy by itself does not guarantee some sort of better version of humanity. It depends on that matriarchy, just how it directs its own energy. How does it treat its subordinates inside it, much less those it conquers in from outside. That, to me, is not the easy answer. But the answer probably lies outside of anything that comes out of the Western intellectual tradition. I mean, they have to come outside of complete, somewhat from them, but I don't think it's going to be something that the philosophy is currently practiced or promoted inside the accepted academy of the Western European, North American kind of tradition. Institutions. It will be something new, a synthesis of that along with other realities on the ground. But it's our challenge and our responsibility to find it, to think about it, cherish the thought of it, find out what technology is doing. Is it all good? What will its effect be? Understand what they have in plan, in store for us. A philosophy. Here's a belief, a belief system. From the 1960s, a man named Paul Ehrlich, who is still alive, wrote a book, I think it was called The Population Bomb. And this became almost like a religion in certain circles, in a lot of circles. The world was getting overpopulated, and we have to limit it. At its worst, resulted in mass and involuntary sterilizations of a lot of people. I'm not going to say where this was. It's a lot to talk about. But it was repeated. There's too many people. Yet. The consensus is now, scientifically, that world population will peak in about 2050 or 2060, which is within the lifetime of many people alive today. And why is that? Because the population of the world isn't because the average woman nowadays is having 7, 8, 9, 10 children. It's because 100 years ago, the average woman was having 7, 8, 9 children. And the branches of humanity that came out of those children who are still alive now are still just having fewer children, but they're exercising their right to have children. But they're having smaller numbers. So if the population is going to peak and then start declining, why should we be taking away the right for certain people to reproduce? Who gets to decide? Who gets to not reproduce? Well, why should one distrust that kind of zero population growth movement? Well, considering its predecessors in the eugenics movement, where they did openly try to limit certain people, family size, but not everyone else. One should be suspicious of that. Alberto Fujimori, the former president of Peru, was accused, and it was accused, it was proven, that they had a massive sterilization program for the people in the mountains, the indigenous people. Sterilization of native people happened up in the United States at least until the 1970s. It was under a federal program. Sterilization of African-American women was also occurring, but it was not under a single federal program. It was done by the states and by the county. So single-minded, and wasn't as probably successful because it was decentralized. There was massive sterilization of women in Puerto Rico in the 1950s. In fact, I knew a woman who said that two of her aunts were victims of that and never had children that they might have wanted to have. And the most recent one was that black women in prison in California were being sterilized. And the doctor who was in charge of this said, well, these children were going to be unwanted. And I'm asking the question, why is it because a woman is in prison now, most of them for short terms, how can we guarantee that she won't want her children? Why, because the mother is a convict now, that the child is unwanted? Unwanted by who? By its own mother or by the doctor? So, those children are unwanted by society. Who says? What gives him the right to say? Well, apparently the state of California gave him the right to say that. But here's a question. Even if those women were, even if the prison hierarchy was only concerned about them giving birth while they were in prison, and therefore a burden for the prison system, how are they getting pregnant? Who's impregnating them while they're in prison? That's an interesting question, because as far as I know, there are no co-ed prisons. Males and female prisoners are kept apart. So you have to just wonder if that eugenics is alive and well. It is alive and well. And it's one of those things to keep an eye on. You know, up in Canada, there's this article I read online. It was a government report about the First Nations people in Canada. The First Nations people have the highest birth rate of all Canadians. And this article, in its first paragraph, essentially this. Yes, First Nation Aboriginal Canadians have more babies, but most of these babies are born out of wedlock. Or most of these babies are born to mothers who haven't finished high school. And most of them are born in poverty. So it's like they're saying, well, they're births, but they don't quite count because they're born with all these social disadvantages. Right? Is that what they're saying? They're somehow less than human because of that? Or were they saying something else? They're not really a threat, right? They're, most of them are starting out in poverty and to single mothers. So these babies are never going to amount to much. So they're never going to be a threat to the rest of us, the non-Indian Canadian. It's hard to make a deal. But the thing is that wording, so the article was recited. I found it several places out on the internet, several newspapers from Canada were quoting it. It was the same government report. The government, Canadian government's own report made that same statement. Yes, First Nations women are having more children, but most of them are born to single mothers, but most of them are born in poverty, but most of them are born and will never finish high school. They're mostly basically born losers. So don't worry about it. Or maybe we should be more worried about it because they're going to be, you know, a burden to the rest of us. I mean, to me, the racism of the article, of the government report, was just so blatant. It's so blatantly obvious. But, you know, you get to wonder, how did this get passed? I mean, someone writes it. It has to be approved by someone in the hierarchy. Why, how did the government say, you know, this doesn't quite sound right from the government to be saying this? But they put it out there. So apparently they're not afraid for anyone to know what they really think of the First Nations people of Canada. Their opinion is out there. I guess sometimes it's good to have an honest opinion, have a realistic assessment of who you're dealing with and what they really think of you. There was back in 2007 or 2005, I think, Education Secretary, I think, under Reagan. Ronald Reagan, press president, and now he works at the Heritage Foundation, the very conservative organization. And he says something, or I think the talk was about crime. He throws off his offhand kind of statement. The timing was interesting about the statement that Bill Bennett made, because he made it at a time when there's a big abortion decision coming before the Supreme Court about that same week. And, but he, what he says, you know, sure we could say, he said offhandedly, sure we could say, that if we wanted to fight crime, we'd just abort every black baby. But, huh? But now I wouldn't really say that. I mean, I wouldn't really want to do that because that's unthinkable, right? But he says it. He says, and then he says it's unthinkable. Why would you say it? He says it in, like, an interview on TV. And he's basically talked about aborting the entire ethnicity out of existence. But it's interesting because it's from the right, and the right is usually against abortion, right? Right to life, pro-life. Yet somehow he was able to casually discuss the eradication of an entire race with that same method, abortion, which is supposedly so appalling. And I remember seeing Bill Bennett and other news, he would be brought in to talk about things. He'd be sitting next to Donna Brazile. Donna Brazile is from New Orleans. I think she's a beautiful, dark-skinned black woman, and she looks like she's a lot native also, which from New Orleans wouldn't be surprised. And I remember seeing her sitting at least one, and they were both the two commentators brought in on CNN or somewhere to talk. And I don't know what her opinion is about Bill Bennett, who I haven't seen in many years now. But I'm wondering, she was a functionary. She ran Al Gore's Democratic campaign, sitting next to him. Because personally, if I was in her position, I don't know if I could have sat next to Bill Bennett. And they talked about some other political stuff, about polls or something. I don't think I could have sat next to him and be part of the same conversation with him as an individual. I don't know if I could have done it, knowing he'd made that statement. I mean, yeah, he never had to officially apologize for that genocidal proposal, but because he apologized almost immediately as he said it. He said it and then apologized for it right away. You know, of course I would never say we could never really abort all of this. No, but if he apologizes almost within the same sentence. That's what's out there. And if you see enough of it, their true colors do come out. Which brings me to another issue. That is the deaths at the hands of the police. A little known fact, and it shouldn't be so little known, is that Native Americans die at the hands of police in higher proportions than black Americans. The numbers of people who are considered Native American is smaller. So the numbers of those being killed are smaller, but proportionally, they recognize Native American, American Indian, as a higher chance of dying at the hands of the police than the so-called black American. Bring this boat together. up in Canada, the disappearance of First Nations women has been the ongoing theme for like 30 years. Disappear. And no investigation, no arrests, gone. Not just one place, not just one reserve, but in several, over the whole country. Why? No. No answer. Now we're seeing more instances of Black American women dying and being abused at the hands of the police. Things that aren't even really crimes. Changing lanes without your turn signal. Things that aren't even really crimes. Not like there's even a robbery or something being reported, or much less, or they're not even crimes, and people are going to jail and then dying for it. I don't have an answer. These are just things I'm throwing out there. As Indigenous people, we have a lot to think about. We have a lot to be concerned about. And we have to hold on. Hold on to hope. Dig deep. Dig into your roots. Learn your family lineage, your clan, your family, who you are related to. That's how we operated for most of our existence. That's how we did it. Know that family. Mel de Trejo, Mel the Red Bear Trejo, she said that she has, I think, 10 children and 29 grandchildren, lives on Pine Ridge Reservation. I actually got to meet her personally back about 20 years ago. She had this Easter egg hunt, and it was done just something fun for the kids to do, and the family brought over, you know, her own grandchildren and other cousins and family, too. And they did this exercise where the people would, like, stand in the circle and they would describe who it was. Well, that's so-and-so, and he's my cousin. He's the son of this person, that person. That's my uncle. He's my uncle. He's a brother to my mother. And they would go around and around so everyone would know how they were related to everybody, who they were connected to. They didn't come into this world by themselves. And that's how they knew. How she taught family. That's just a passing thought. That's a passing thought. Well, I put another language video up, Muskogee. I had not put one up in several months. I hope my YouTube audience and subscribers are lapping it up. And I hope for all of you have a good week. And maybe next week, one of you who listen to me in the archives will call me up. I'm trying to do it around 11 p.m. on Saturday night. It might be a little later next week, maybe 11:30 or 12. But you can check on the Blog Talk schedule if you follow it. They'll tell you when it is. I'll plan the date out. Schedule the time out early enough so that you can find it in the next few weeks. I'll be on more regularly. We'll have some good conversations on the air. What's facing us? What shall we do? Until next time, Chichichatlis. Atam Chichichatlis.